Michael Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about
a molecular tour of DMT, a dimethyl something or other. It's a hallucinogenic bark that Amazon Indians were getting by actually boiling up bark and smoking it, or whatever it is. I don't believe that. Oh, it has to be smoked. So I'm actually going to do that tour, and also a tour of glyphosate, which is Roundup. And the reason I'm doing these two things is that I've read the New Scientist, and both these things featured in the most recent New Scientist from the 25th of October. I've done a little series of podcasts on that. The reason I'm doing it is that it's always good to do molecular tours. It's sort of like that big thing to add on and extend your knowledge of things that you come across. And it's an adjunct or an extension of the New Scientist. The New Scientist mentions these things and they sort of talk about it. They don't expect you to actually go into it. And sort of why I'm doing too is that I'm slowly raising the bar in rehab and recall and memory. So it's obviously, you know, if someone asks you one thing, and then you recall it, it's easy. But if they ask two things, it's more difficult. It's like when I went on holiday, I packed a sock, a bag of toothpaste, a banana, and it goes on. And people have to go back and recite that. So we have to remember multiple things. It's more like a parlor game. So I'm gradually pushing it. So on certain fronts, I think I will advertise the app in which I just download all the or contains all the podcasts, so you can see by month or whatever it is, all inside the podcast. So I will download that or let you see it. But you can see that I've gone to taking 9 episodes to just slowly read through a New Scientist, not completely, and it's down to 3. I might get down to 2 eventually, who knows. It's taking close on 2.5 hours to read a New Scientist aloud end to end, going through. And as you do it, you kind of get to these things. So it's the overall raising the bar. So DMT, it's a molecule, hallucinogenic molecule, and it's mentioned in a series of articles. Yeah, in general, there's sort of one article every 2 or 3 New Scientists about some sort of hallucinogenic drugs and how it's actually could be quite good to use it. And this particular one is saying that it's a strong hallucinogen and gives you a near-death experience, an out-of-body experience. And so they quoted this person's research where they actually got a group of people who said, look, I had out-of-body experiences, and people who take the drugs and actually compared, oh yes, it is, gives you a near-death experience, which I suppose is interesting because it tells you about how when the body, when the brain is switching off for the last time, it becomes very calm and insightful. This feeling of insightfulness goes through just before you snuff it, which is interesting. So let's get to it. Now, there's the characteristic pentagon on a hexagon. So a hexagon of carbons and then a pentagon on top. So some of the things which are like that are adenine, which is adenine is the base for adenosine, and adenosine triphosphate is your energy molecule. That's one thing we've seen. It's also, I think it could be caffeine. It's a very similar type of thing. And speed is a very similar type of thing. I'll just have to really rack my brain to think about with caffeines in there. These are flat molecules. And as flat molecules, they're not flexible. And it's sort of like they're a key to unlock things or lock things together. So you can imagine if you had a key, you want your key to be solid, you don't want it to be rubbery and flexible. And so they have a role of being having chemical activity centers at precise, known, rigid locations. So if you hold it one place, you are projecting from holding one point, it's like going to the other. So the equivalent of, I think, the way that you could imagine it, it's sort of like a fork. In that you hold it at one end and the prongs are at a certain point, so you can maneuver by holding one end of the fork, you maneuver the prongs at the other end. And that's very much, adenine. You hold it, the sugar holds it at one end and it puts these hydrogen bonds, a fork of hydrogen, or a two-prong fork of hydrogen bonds, thionine, I suppose, adenine and thionine. There's two-pronged forks, they stick together in that way. And so it's got a certain rigidity of the backbone, which is a very, very common backbone of a pentagon and a hexagon. Now, a hexagon is the sort of pure carbon benzene, and it tells you of pi electrons. When we say pi electrons, so most of the time when you see a chemical, it's a ball and stick model, and most of the time you think that the electrons are in that stick. So electrons are the negatively charged light. They're not actually small, they're actually big. That's a hard thing to get across. But then the glue, so a molecule is a system of atoms, an ordered system of atoms, a pattern of atoms. So if you've got a set of Lego blocks of, say, five colours, and you put together your Lego in a particular way, and you can say to your brothers and friends and sisters and stuff like that who are putting it, build copies of this. And if they copied it exactly, that system of blocks together, that system of atoms, equivalent system of atoms, they're making a molecule. So when you might say build up something which just looks a bit like a horse, you know, like five Lego blocks together looks a bit like a horse, tell other people to do that, and that pattern of particular blocks and particular orientation is there. And the general sort of assumption is, because with most things you stick together, it's glued together. If you build a model or stick something together, you glue one part onto the next. You don't have this thing, which is the quantum mechanical thing, of the glue forming a cloud as a sort of an overall splint for your molecule. And so we sort of tend to think of molecules a bit like the way we think of arms, sort of that they're joints, variable joints, they're stiff bits and stuff like that. But if you've got a broken arm, you can put it in a splint, and so there's actually support above and below your arm. And so a hexagon of atoms, the electrons splint around it. Now, just to give you an idea, so the average, a benzene molecule, which is six carbons, six hydrogens, so internal ring of six carbons and an external ring of six hydrogens, and then two other rings, a ring of three electrons at the top, three electrons at the bottom, there are six binding electrons. Now, when I say there are six electrons, electrons aren't sort of county things, you know, like marbles or peas on your plate. They're not county things like that. They're not individual things. They can actually flow through each other. And they can form splints. Benzene is a splinted molecule. It's got a top splint and a bottom splint. And so the joints can't flex because they're splinted. Now, an extreme example of that is it's not pyrene, it's the heme molecule. Okay, the heme blood molecule, listen, you're using it at the moment. You're using heaps of heme molecules at the moment. Heme molecules are great because they, when activated by iron, that is iron, that is physical iron, as in iron of a sword in Game of Thrones type of iron. It's not, well, valyrium steel, isn't it? Well, I don't know. It's iron and steel, that type of iron, that's inside your blood. Does it make it red? I don't think so, but people think, oh, it's rust, and when you bruise, you can see the iron, you can see other things. It's this heme molecule around the outside. Heme molecule has got, well, I'm talking only a hexagon and a pentagon. It's got pentagons with these nitrogens inside the pentagon, so it's generally made of carbons, but occasionally you can do away with a bond. And nitrogen has three bonds, carbon has four. You can do away with a bond and actually have a nitrogen in there. But, and so this is definitely inside the heme molecule. Heme molecule is absolutely ripper. Okay, so when we've got three and we might have five of this called pi electrons, so splinting electrons above and below the plane, this has got a staggering 22, you know, and if you can think of these electrons not as little pieces on your plate, but now as sound waves, it's sort of like, you know, in the old TDK does amazing things to our system, that type of thing, that those little, those classic sound waves, or if you're watching the news and you're hearing someone quoted, and so they put someone's face, and then they put sort of a bar to show the sound waves. That you can imagine those electrons as a beautiful wave, sort of like a drum. It is like a stretched drum. That's exactly what it is, like a stretched drum. I don't know where. That's can I say this is where doing quantum physics expands your life. You can sort of, I don't know, see things. The average person listens to the bum drum. They're not the bum. Listen to the drum and hears the beat. But you can actually feel and see the beat of electrons, these pi electrons sitting up there. And once you see that, see the quantum mechanics of it, it's absolutely stunningly beautiful. So the heme molecule is sort of this on steroids, and it's a beautiful thing to do. It's a box of inward pointing pyramids, which actually point four of these plus one supplied by the actual hemoglobin molecule, nitrogen point and hold that iron. And you can sort of see, well, I can sort of imagine how it does its magic in slowing down the oxygen and taming the oxygen molecule. And of course, when the oxygen molecule gets disturbed with too much carbon dioxide, it flies off. Too much carbon dioxide means there's a cell which is coughing and breathing and making heaps of carbon dioxide. You cell, you need a bit more oxygen. That's what hemoglobin does. But we're getting back to it. So we're DMT, whereas heme's got four of these pentagons, this is one pentagon, and it's sitting above a little circle of carbon, a ring of carbon, a six-membered ring of carbon. And we're going to do this orientation thing again of putting the pentagon stuck to a hexagon. And I sort of trying to think, house and B, a house is pentagon shape. If anyone has to draw a house, they draw a floor, two walls, and a roof. It's like a pentagon. I see that as a house. And hexagon, I imagine, as a B. But what happens, when you see beehives, the actual vertices are pointing up and down. Just rotate that 390 degrees. So the vertices, the sharp bits of your hexagon, left and right, and the flat bits on the table. Imagine it's on the table and you fold it upwards. Unfortunately, you know, when I'm imagining things, I'm going to try and do it. I'm imagining things as part of the memory stakes. I flip it up out of the page, and so the base of the hexagon is down, the apex is left and right, and going up, there's a flat bit there, and on top of that you sit a little house, a pentagon house, stuff like that. Now, when you're doing adenine, there's nitrogens just everywhere, but this one's only got one nitrogen in it, and you also have to pay attention to what's stuck to the nitrogen. Nitrogen's a three bond thing. It can actually have a few pi electrons. It can sort of bond multiply in its ring, sort of. Or it can have a separate bond out of it, a third bond out, sticking to its mate, hydrogen. And this is the case here. But unlike the nitrogenous base, so when they say base, they mean key. You know, I think that would be the better interlocking keys. I think really a nitrogenous key, I prefer them called. There's lots of words which I think. When we talk about it, it's actually better to use another word. It's closer. When it's all said and done, and it's all explained, you say, well, you know, the word that you originally told me to, that's the best word for that is key. Or if there's, say, a flap which opens in a cell, for instance, there's something which opens and it's hinged, rather than calling it something else, at the end of the day, you mean it's a door. So really, the base is a better thing to call, I think of it as a rigid key. Yeah. Nitrogenous, okay, there's lots of nitrogens, and it's a rigid key. And of course, these drugs are also keys. You know, they're keys that unlock your brain. They're keys which go in and stuff all your machinery in your brain, and your brain basically drugs itself. The drug itself, I don't think, actually causes hallucination. The drug interacts and your brain self-hallucinates. That's what I can see. So, your basic key is this house B, or pentagon, hexagon. The hexagon, in this case, is pure carbon, and the pentagon is absolutely beautiful. It's got only one nitrogen in it. And so, going around, so we've got the, if I can just describe it, you've got the floor, you've got the two walls, and you've got the roof. The left-hand roof-wall connection, that nitrogen there, that's got that atom there is whip it out of carbon, put in a nitrogen, and onto that you stick a hydrogen. Now the other carbons around the place, if they can, if there's the right number of bonds, they have a hydrogen on it. But we put a hydrogen on there just to say, look mate, look at that. That's got a hydrogen in it. That nitrogen's not contributing pi electrons, too many pi electrons to the bisone. That this electron is fully pushed over, dealing with a nitrogen in there. And so it's sort of an interesting thing. So if it was an oxygen, there wouldn't be a nitrogen in there. There wouldn't be, if it was oxygen, the hydrogen would be actually, if you can imagine the hydrogen, it's actually just pulled across to inside the nucleus. So really a hydrogen and nitrogen is equivalent to an oxygen. Sort of like it's like a broken oxygen. That's just one thing to consider. So what have we got so far? You've got, if you can imagine, B, hexagon. I'm just giving you memory clues. And look, I don't know how my memory works. I'm just working it out here. B, hexagon at the bottom. The top, house, pentagon. The house, pentagon at the top. You've got a nitrogen in the loop. And it's got a little satellite dish setting of hydrogen. When I say satellite dish, I'm just trying to help your imagination along. Now, as on the other side, on the right-hand roof wall connection, is, if you'd like, a little chimney. You know those, the old drawings of houses? We've got a little chimney of of two carbons. Well, we may as well. There's too many stuff, and I'll have to scrub it because there's carbons and sort of a nitrogen, which is, you know, just a toast, just a really enjoyable nitrogen to contemplate. Now, look, this is ever so simply similar to speed. Speed, I'll have to remember, revisit the number of nitrogens, but speed, rather than being anything special, it's basically, if you can imagine the hexagon underneath as an under the ground basement area, and it's got a little drain pipe of coming out of a couple of carbons and a amine group. So that's methamphetamine, amine, it's amine in there. That's in speed, but we're going back to this is DMT, which is your happy drug. I think it's not a Schedule 1, I think it's way down a Schedule 9 drug in Australia. So you can be prescribed it, but don't tell me you've been using it for the wrong thing again. So, it's one of the drugs in here that doctors can use. use over here. Okay, so let's go. We've got the house with the nitrogen, with the nitrogen on the left roof wall thing, with a little satellite dish of hydrogen on. On the other side, we've got underneath at the basement of a ring of six carbons. So in that ring of carbons, we've got six on the base, and then another two carbons in that pentagon, because the pentagon's got five, but the two are double counted for the base of the hexagon. They're shared between the hexagon and the pentagon. The pentagon's at the top, and so there's two extra carbons there, and then there's one nitrogen in there with a hydrogen. Move across to the right hand wall and roof section. That carbon in there is hooked on to another carbon. So there's double jointed, two more carbons there, and after that it's hooked on to a nitrogen, and the nitrogen has three bonds. Carbon's got four, nitrogen's got three bonds. So it could be, if it was unlucky, it could be, or if you're lucky, it could be bonded onto two hydrogens at the end, and that would be an amine. However, this is bound onto further onto two carbons. So it's, imagine like it's a Y joint. So carbons can act as a four hole joint, generally in three dimensions. And hydrogens is definitely a flat dimension wide joint, and that is carbon in. Nitrogen goes to two other carbons, and those carbons themselves are complete with three hydrogens on the outside. I can actually see it there. This is like this chimney coming out of your house, which is a pentagon at the top, and it's got two joints. Okay, it goes from a carbon up to a carbon, and then to another carbon. And so that middle carbon between the roof joint and the next one up, that will have two hydrogens on it, because it's got to have four bonds. The next one, I have one hydrogen on it, and then one into the nitrogen, and that nitrogen will be bonded to two more carbons further up, because it's a Y bond, three-prong thing. And those carbons will correspond to three hydrogens. I'm sort of beginning to count them already. So let's count up the nitrogens. There's two nitrogens all in all, one in the roof section and one at the end of the chimney where it starts at. Let's see, there's six, two, two, two. There's 12 carbons and the hydrogens. I'll let you work that out. So it's an interesting molecule, because it's, in terms of how it goes, there's a lot of pi electrons, it's got a key shape, but then the other thing, I can imagine that nitrogen with the other thing acting sort of a molecular club. I can't see it doing very much. I can see it stopping things that club can sort of mend and flex into and really stuff up a pathway. But it's also, that's one of the fundamental things, the this molecule is really like alcohol can get through the blood-brain barrier. These molecules are nice and small, get through the blood-brain barrier. And of course, I don't know, the kidneys have these things which, these macromolecules, these globulins which absorb all these types of things. They slit in, they're like carriers for them in your blood. How do these molecules aren't floating free in your blood? Or they can a little bit, but in general they adhere to the ambulum thing, which is this fantastic sort of multiple suitcase molecule, which has got all these sulfur bonds, and it draws up sodium ions, and it's this fantastic little molecule. And this comes along, it gets squeezed in your brain, these molecules get transported into your brain, and this sort of thing means that there's a molecule when it goes into your blood. Say if you were to eat it, apparently eating it is not the best way to do it. You've got to smoke it or inject it. But if you eat it, it goes into your blood, gets cleaned out by your kidneys, gets what we call, quote-unquote, metabolized. And there's this fundamental cleaning process, which means that this drug lasts for a couple of hours max before your liver comes along and cleans it, and it cleans it up. And then that various junk gets along with your dead blood molecules. So you basically it's the liver is actually checking out your blood all the time, knocking off your blood molecules, unwraps your heme, so it turns your heme molecules, and it just chucks it out, surfactant into your gallbladder, and just chucks it into your stomach, into your duodenum, and it goes out. So eventually, the end of it, if you were to eat this, it would go straight into your bile, into your bile duct. So you eat into your stomach, goes in your stomach, in your small intestine, then tries to go into your bloodstream. Your liver, it's got a good cleaning factor, will clean it up. However, if you smoke or inject it, if you inject it, there's no way that your liver can actually do it. So why is smoking? I think because your liver sits the most common source of rubbish going to your bloodstream is stomach. Like, your stomach's this huge porous thing, and, junk just bleeds from it. Okay, some of it's good, some of it's bad, and so it goes straight from your stomach into your liver and cleans out. But if you smoke it, or inject it, obviously it can bypass the liver and get into your head, give you happy hallucinations. So that just re-summarizes that. That's a hexagon of all carbons, a pentagon with a nitrogen in it off the side, and then a little chimney of two carbons, a nitrogen, and onto those two nitrogens, another two carbons, and hydrogens just decorating the whole stuff. So that's DMT. Now, one of the DMT, MDT is mobile drug testing. So if you type in drugs and your brain's not pumping it up right, and so you can see just by memorizing so many different molecules, I've got a certain pattern, and there's a certain amount of things which are sort of stock standard, which help you remember, but that's not, I'm not cheating, I'm still remembering it. It's just that's sort of a check thing to actually, as things have been built in your working memory there, and then as it's worked in memory, as you're talking about it, you can actually see if you can visualize, communicate, all good mental stuff. Okay, now the other molecule we've got too is glyphosate. Now, phosphate, as opposed to phosphate. So ADP, ADT, adenine, ATP. Oh, there you go. Bloody hell. You can see me trying to, phosphate and phosphate. And now, don't quote me on it, but I think a phosphate is something which is stuck. So phosphorus can make five bonds. Now making five bonds, it's got an oxygen with it, So sulfur is next to phosphorus. Yeah, it goes phosphorus sulfur. So it's got one less electron in its thing, but it can make 5 bonds, and then bond to 4 oxygens, a double bond to 2 single bonds to oxygen, and then the oxygen itself, either the other oxygen, the other oxygen's always got two bonds. So it can actually, oxygen either bond to your phosphorus and then bond to a hydrogen. So you've got phosphoric acid, and that's H3PO4. Now, that's because there's not the bonding there, so the oxygen's got a not bond, and so it can actually bond to hydrogens. And so that's pretty interesting. The bottom line is that if you are trying to actually force your poor students, to do the Lewis dot diagram for phosphorus or sulfur, you're really pushing the analogy too far. Phosphorus and sulfur, they're on the next level. They're just a little bit away from d orbitals. There's five bonds. It forms 5 bonds. The number of electrons and shells, it just really doesn't work. You can draw sort of 5, I forgot what they're called, isomeric diagrams of, it could be this, it could be that, it could be that, and the negative charge is an electron, there's a tiny little electron, it's a little dot, of course the electron isn't a dot, so that's a lie anyway. I don't know if you know, you can draw it there. So you just really have to accept that phosphorus has 5 bonds in the side, so that's actually 10 electrons in its shell. And 10 electrons in its shell, it's allowed to do, because there's actually 18 electrons in that shell. So it goes 1 times 2, then the next shell is 2 squared times 2. So that's 8 electrons. Next one is 3 squared by 2. That's 18 electrons. You're allowed to have 18 electrons in the next shell. So, 10 bonds. Sorry, 5 bonds, 10 electrons. What's the deal? As Seinfeld would say, what's the deal with such and such? Yeah, I don't know. I just despair seeing people try and do the Lewis dot diagram for it, and then coming up with something which just drives students into the ground. We have to talk about that because glyphosate is something. So the phosphates, I believe, I'm not absolutely sure. No one's taught me this. I'm relearning this. So I still haven't remembered all the time about where I learnt the various things. And so I'll know something's right, and I'll be going, where did I learn it? Is that right? And then some of the times I'll work out, that was a wrong thing which I used to learn to help keep people happy or something. Especially if you're doing quantum physics and you're dealing with people who don't do quantum physics, there's certain explanations which you just can't talk about. It's similar to the previous molecule, DMT. Well, I'm talking about splinting of electrons. You just cannot say that to someone who doesn't do quantum physics. It's sort of pi electrons. They're not flexible. They just don't. You just have to avoid it. So all these things, you have to remember it. But I believe phosphate has got 3 oxygens around your, still 5 bonds. 3 oxygens, a double bond of the oxygen, and 2 single bonds of the oxygen, which have to have hydrogens on them to cap them off to do it. And then a bond of the carbon directly. A phosphate is the carbons bonded directly in there. Which is fairly simple. That's a phosphate. Phosphate is 4 oxygens around the outside. And so your, adenosine triphosphate is the phosphorus is oxygen, is a phosphor completely surrounded by oxygen. A phosphate, it's surrounded by most of the oxygen, but it's this little bond direction that should come in here. And of course the phosphorus, being the way it is, and the quantum mechanics, it's this, you know, and oxygen being electron, huge electron affinity, relatively high electron affinity, you can actually pull it out. Now, the interesting thing is fluorine's got a lower electron affinity, chlorine's got a massive electron affinity. So, they've got phosphorus, and there's a bird, just wreaking absolute havoc around here. What if it's trying to kill something up here? Okay, so we've got the phosphorus, we've got three oxygens around it. One's a double bonded, one's single bonded to it, and the other oxygen, the other bond of that oxygen goes to a hydrogen. That's your phosphate, as opposed to phosphate, which is a phosphorus, and it's got four oxygens around it. And those oxygens, three of those oxygens are single bonded, so they have to be bonded to something else. They could either be bonded to hydrogens, or they could be bonded to anything else you like. And so that's phosphate. Phosphate, as far as it goes. So we're actually, that's the way we're building it. So, that's a phosphate. Basically, what else can you say? It's a phosphorus, three oxygens, two of those have got hydrogens on it, one is a double bonded, so it's just there with its, sticking its, you know, bent over, sticking out its electron pairs to the world, to the sea. And then the other one, sticking through it, is a carbon bond. And that carbon bond is then linked on to, it's almost over before I say it, glycine. So glycine, what is an amino acid? It's hooked onto the amine group of the amino acid, and glycine is sort of like this, the world's simplest amino acid. So let's, if you can just put the phosphate down for the moment, it's got carbon, and that carbon is actually hooked into the nitrogen of an amino acid. And I hope I'm right on this. I think I am right on it. And that amino acid, so that's what happens. Amino acids link, a linked carbon, or nitrogen, carbon with an oxygen, which is linked to the next nitrogen. And this is, all proteins are linear polymer of varying, amino acids. And amino acids have got this, band of nitrogen, carbon, carbon, nitrogen, carbon, carbon, nitrogen, carbon, nitrogen. And in fact, if you can imagine, if you class, you can actually get, and they love it. You get them to bang the desk for the two carbons, clap your hand for the nitrogen. So it's bang, oh, I can't do it here, but bang, bang, clap. It's really good because it actually really goes, do it. And you can go, so, there's a way that you can actually get it in as this sort of general, get the real energy of the protein into kids' minds going that way. Okay, so, what is an amino acid? An amino? An acid. It's like Seinfeld saying, what's the deal with amino acids? They're not amines and they're not acids. Well, in fact, they are both, you know. But you've got the amine, which is N2, hooked to a carbon, which is hooked down to a side chain, which is the charm of your, this is charm sticking on there, hooked to an acid, which is a carbon with an oxygen and a double bonded oxygen and a single bonded oxygen and hydrogen. And that little combination is the acid group. Now, of course, the way it's drawn in school books is it's a double bond and a single one. What's actually really happening is those two oxygens are pretty much identical. That could, and, the electrons in it can actually flow between the two. You can actually build an orbital between it, and the hydrogen is actually just drifting above and below. Those beautiful things to actually, that's where quantum mechanics gives you a, it's sort of like, the school ball and stick is like reading comics. Yeah, it's the comic book version, and quantum mechanics is full CGI, that you get a full cinematic experience. Things move, it's actually like the moving pictures. It's sort of like this way chemicals are drawn are a bit like cave drawings. So like, ah, that's a woolly mammoth, that's someone with a spear throwing it. But this, quantum mechanics is full CGI. So glycine is the simplest amino acid. So amino acid is nitrogen, carbon, carbon. And it's nitrogen, amine, carbon side chain, carbon acid. And the carbon acids are the oxygen, two oxygens. And the simplest side chain is side chain whatsoever. That's the simplest. It's the sound of silence. Glycine is just two hydrogens, a nitrogen. I'm just reading across two hydrogens and nitrogen. A carbon, which has got two hydrogens, no side chain. What? If it had, it can have sort of an alcohol stuck onto it. A sulfol, I don't know what I call a sulfol. You can have all these different things. You get all these beautiful asparic acid. That is, it's found in asparagus. I love that. And then you get met and various other things. Really interesting to go across it. But this glycol is just nothing. So glycol is a nothing. It's like the boring, absolutely boring, teetotaling, amino acids. So it's there. It's really just, it's just like, it's a placeholder amino acid. It doesn't do anything except actually just build your protein. It's got no, suppose it has properties. It's got no real properties. It's just a nothing. So it's really small. And so that's, glycine. Now that glycine, now if I can reboot you, that carbon, which is stuck to your phosphate, the carbon has got two hydrogens, another bond, and that bond goes up to the nitrogen. Now how it does it, obviously it would have an OH at one stage, and the amine has got two H's and an N. That H and OH pinch off together, you can imagine squeezing together, and it actually physically does this type of stuff, my friend, because what happens is these precursors are actually stretched, and the bond is held, stretched out, and the bond's almost broken, and the amine says, "Ah, mate, can I help you? And you need a hydrogen." Yep, the water's gone. You're stuck with me. The carbon sticks to the nitrogen, has a hydrogen in it, then goes to a carbon with two hydrogens, a carbon with two oxygens, and a hydrogen on it. So let's go. This is your roundup. And there's several things you're saying. How that, there's various things which are carcinogenic, which are very obviously carcinogenic. Or, well, not, you know, like the smallest molecule I know which is carcinogenic is toluene. But this is just really an enzyme inhibitor. Like, it as far as I can see, doesn't affect it. So this is your roundup, and we'll talk about it and talk about how it works, and then I'll do a final memory test on top of it. So it's got two hydrogens working from the left to the right. Two hydrogens bonded to two oxygens, and that's three oxygen all in all. That's one with just a double bond and no hydrogen. So two hydrogens and electron clouds, three oxygens, a phosphorus, which has got now four bonds to oxygens and one bond to the next carbon. That carbon's got two hydrogens on it, because it's got four bonds. Then it goes up to a nitrogen, which has got one hydrogen on it, and its next bond is to a carbon, which has got two hydrogens on it, because it's useless. It's a glycine, which is then connected to a carbon, which has two oxygens, a double bond and a single bond, and one of those is to a hydrogen. But in reality, that hydrogen is just floating there. In fact, the hydrogens at the other end are also two, are floating between those three oxygens. You know, it's a lot more fluid and beautiful to see how it goes. Now, that goes into a plant. And what it does is the plant is busily, when it's saying, it's time to grow, and it says, let's whir the machinery around, and the plant actually has to produce things not too dissimilar to glycophosphate. And so there's three vitamins that it makes. So vitamin means life-giving amines. So in you have basically you have to produce DNA, RNA, proteins, and you also have to produce bits. Your chemical factory has to produce amines, and amines which you can't produce are you have to produce them yourself. So plants produce themselves. You produce amines yourself, vite amines. You can imagine me going up to chemist warehouse and someone says vitamins, and I don't understand them. You mean vite amines. You know, there you go. So that's the general summary of it. So this is when a plant grows, its enzymes fire up, and this stuffs it. So it's a little like in the war movies, when you turn the key in the ignition, the little Jeep blows up. Like this is what happens. Is that you've got a plant, you put the weed killer on, zero, and it's all okay, everything's all okay, but the moment that sunlight hits it and it's got to do some growing, it goes, oh, God. So I could well imagine that what happens is that rather than producing the so this is the phosphate is taken up into the plant, so this is when it's called, it can have a series of things. It has to be taken into the plant as a nutrient, thinking, hey, I've got these, I bought this glycophosphate down at the pub, it fell off the back of a truck, it'll work, let's use it for cooking. And it's sort of like this oil puts in there, and it's all okay. But as soon as the plant starts to grow, these enzymes don't get produced. And you can imagine that if it hasn't got enough vitamin, it actually will detect this and ask for more. That's the way DNA works in terms of that. It will keep on producing genes for something until enough of what it produces there, and it forms equilibrium. But if it's been locked away, it will just burn itself out. And so you can see that with Roundup. And of course, what's happening nowadays is that as the chemical companies are pumping out heaps and heaps and heaps of things, the evolution's going, you know what? I think we'll do something else. That's a bad idea. And so we're having a whole heap of weeds that are glyphosate resistant. So that's DMT and glyphosate. That's a doubler. And if I can do about 10 minutes here, as people will know that I'm trying to remember the periodic table, and you have heard me read the periodic table, go through groups, go for stuff, and it's probably the fifth time I've tried to remember the periodic table. But as you go through, the sort of the checking can be faster, and you can load things up into working memory, and you've got two levels of working memory to go across, and you can see. And so once, you know, there's like learning anything. It's like studying. You've got to really study how to get it. So here's the periodic table. So this is the, and this is a memory stuff. Okay, hydrogen, helium, lithium, beryllium, boron, carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, fluorine, neon, sodium, magnesium, aluminium, silicon, phosphorus, sulfur, chlorine, argon, potassium, calcium, scandium, titanium, vanadium, chromium, manganese, iron, cobalt, nickel, copper, zinc, gallium, germanium, arsenic, selenium, bromine, krypton, rubidium, strontium, yttrium, zirconium, niobium, molybdenum, technetium, ruthenium, rubidium, palladium, silver, cadmium, indium, indium, tin, antinium, antinomy, SB, tellurium, iodine, xenon, cesium, barium, lanthanum, cerium, praseodymium, neodymium, promethium, samarium, europium, gallium, terbium, dysprosium, holmium, erbium, thulium, ytterbium, lutetium, hafnium, tantalum, tungsten, ruthenium, osmium, iridium, platinum, gold, mercury, thallium, lead, bismuth, polonium, actinium, radon, are you cheering me on at the moment? Francium, francium, there's one thing there, radium, actinium, thorium, proactinium, uranium, neptunium, plutonium, americium, curium, getting a bit fuzzy there. So there you go. And this is, I think what's more fascinating is the memory process going in. So to actually get there, you have to study really hard, then you sort of have a backup working memory. So you've got your working memory, which you put it into. You've got your backup memory, working memory, where it's going ahead and error checking. And so when you say something, you sort of start to error check it coming across. And as that goes, you go across, and then eventually things go into different parts of working memory to get it across. So that's a big effort to get it out there, and I've only done 53 minutes of memory work, and I'll see, I really have to add a drug and an amino acid together to really push it. There's lots of really interesting things. I might do phenylphthalein again. And pyrene. There's chemicals which, you know, you just really, really want to just shake people up and say, look, this is really important. And that's, pyrene, which is this, 4-hexagon, fairly simple, straight, amazing molecule. So I don't know what it's used for. I'll have to think about it. But it's 2% of coal tar. So when you get coal and you heat it up and you form that juicy goop on the out of it, 2% of it, which is quite an amount of it, is this big of a chemical. Probably, I don't know whether it's carcinogenic or not, but it's Coal's pretty amazingly nasty stuff. And you can knock off a fair amount of the chemicals in it by looking at it. So this is worthwhile looking at it. Thanks a lot for listening. And I'll get back on to work. Thanks a lot. Another podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.